From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They must understand that what fuels their industry is really the blood of other people. And therefore, a greater sense of responsibility across the waters is demanded from this government.
Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, the Nigerian writer, talks about oil in the Niger Delta, the effect of Iraq on Africa, and his new memoir, You Must Set Forth at Dawn. But first, Israel's announced it holds the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority directly responsible for Monday's suicide bombing. Hamas has said the attack was justified. We'll look at the state of the occupied territories as international funding is increasingly cut off. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At the White House Tuesday, President Bush refused to rule out the use of nuclear weapons and the impasse over Iran's nuclear program.
When you talk about Iran and you talk about how you have diplomatic efforts, you also say all options are on the table. Does that include the possibility of a nuclear strike? Is that something that your administration will plan for?
All options are on the table. We want to solve this issue diplomatically, and we're working hard to do so. The best way to do so is, therefore, there to be a united effort with countries who recognize the danger of Iran having a nuclear weapon.
President Bush was also questioned on another issue that's dominated news from the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld.
But what do you say to critics who believe that you're ignoring the advice of retired generals, military commanders, who say that there needs to be a change?
I say I listen to all voices. But mine's the final decision. And Don Rumsfeld is doing a fine job. He's not only transforming the military, he's fighting a war on terror. He's helping us fight a war on terror. I have strong confidence in Don Rumsfeld. I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. And what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
In Colombia, President Álvaro Uribe is facing a potential political crisis amid renewed charges over his alleged dealings with paramilitary groups. The new allegations have come from a former senior official at Colombia's Executive Intelligence Agency, the DAS. The official, Rafael Garcia, has told journalists and prosecutors the DAS provided the paramilitary groups with the names of union leaders and academics, many of whom were subsequently threatened or killed. According to Garcia, the paramilitaries also helped Uribe win an extra 300,000 fraudulent votes during the 2002 presidential elections. And Garcia also says he has proof the DAS worked with paramilitaries to assassinate several key Venezuelan leaders, including President Hugo Chavez. After initial denials, Jorge Noguera, the former director of the DAS, admitted he met with a leading paramilitary commander known as Jorge 40. Uribe himself admitted to holding direct meetings with another paramilitary commander, but blasted the media for pursuing the story. Jose Miguel Vivanco, America's director at Human Rights Watch, said, quote, President Uribe's aggressive response raises suspicions about whether he actually wants the truth known and has a chilling effect on the exercise of freedom of expression. In Iraq, handwriting experts testifying in the trial of Saddam Hussein say they've authenticated his signature on documents relating to a crackdown on Iraqi Shiites in the 1980s. The documents reportedly include an order for the killings of 148 Shia opponents of Saddam Hussein's regime. In Israel, the government has announced it holds the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority directly responsible for Monday's suicide bombing. Nine people were killed, dozens were wounded in the attack, making it the deadliest Palestinian assault on Israel in almost 2 years. Meanwhile, Israeli troops clash with hundreds of Palestinian stone throwers in the West Bank city of Nablus Wednesday. Israeli forces reportedly fired tear gas, rubber-coated steel pellets, and some live rounds at the crowds. Israeli troops also arrested more than 20 Palestinians in raids across the West Bank. The father of the Tel Aviv bomber was reported to be among those detained. We'll have more from Israel after headlines. The Bush administration is coming under criticism for giving a warm reception to a leader widely decried as one of the world's most brutal living dictators in Washington last week. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice greeted the Equatorial Guinean President Teodoro Obiang Nguema, whom she called, quote, a good friend. Obiang has ruled Equatorial Guinea since 1979. According to the neoconservative group Freedom House, only seven countries rank worse in respect for political and civil liberties. In an editorial that appeared Tuesday, the Washington Post said, quote, if President Bush and Ms. Rice want anyone to take their pro-democracy rhetoric seriously, they must stop throwing bouquets to odious dictators. In other news, a new study from the American Medical Association argues consolidation among health insurance companies has created virtual monopolies in cities across the U.S. In 56% of nearly 300 metropolitan areas, one single provider controls at least half the local health insurance market. The study says 43 states have levels of market concentration that would normally be expected to lead to antitrust investigations. According to the AMA, more than 400 mergers have taken place in the health insurance industry over the last decade. Meanwhile, premium costs paid by average consumers have seen double-digit increases far above inflation and wage hikes. Indicted former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has disclosed he raised over $480,000 in campaign funds during the six-week period before he announced he would step down. DeLay's campaigning raised his war chest to $1.4 million. Critics have speculated DeLay put off announcing his retirement in order to use the campaign period to fundraise for his legal defense. In other news, a group of prominent U.S. physicists has written an open letter to President Bush urging him to refrain from nuclear weapons against Iran. The letter's signatories include five Nobel laureates and a recipient of the National Medal of Science. According to the physicists, the use of nuclear weapons would be, quote, gravely irresponsible with disastrous consequences for the security of the United States and the world, unquote. Cuba's in the midst of commemorating the 45th anniversary of the U.S. organized Bay of Pigs invasion. On April 17, 1961, a group of over 1,400 fighters, armed, trained, and directed by the Kennedy administration, landed on Cuba's shores in an attempt to overthrow Cuban President Fidel Castro. Within days, the fighters were defeated in what proved to be a major embarrassment for the Kennedy administration and the CIA. Jose Ramon, who fought for the Cuban government during the Bay of Pigs, reflected on the battle.
Every year we celebrate this. It is celebrated in all of the country, and it brings us great memories. I don't wish for this to happen again, not only here, but anywhere else in the world.
The Chronicle of Higher Education has revealed the FBI is seeking to search through the files of the late investigative journalist Jack Anderson. Anderson, whose legendary career included exposés of the Iran-Contra scandal and the CIA's attempts to kill Cuban leader Fidel Castro, died in December at the age of 83. Federal investigators say they want access to Anderson's files to recover classified documents and seek out evidence that could be used in the current prosecution of two pro-Israel lobbyists. Anderson's family has turned down the FBI's request. During his lifetime, Anderson was viewed with derision by several administrations. He earned a spot on President Nixon's infamous enemies list and was reportedly subject of a poisoning operation ordered by a White House aide. And Chinese leader Hu Jintao is in the United States for his first official presidential visit. Hu's trip began Tuesday in Washington State, where he dined at the home of Microsoft head Bill Gates, along with such guests as Starbucks chair Howard Schultz and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Today, Hu is expected to tour the manufacturing plant of the aerospace giant Boeing, just days after China finalized a $5 billion deal with the company. Hu will then head to Washington, D.C. for a meeting with President Bush on Thursday, who was met by dozens of protesters representing Falun Gong practitioners and supporters of Taiwanese and Tibetan independence. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the situation in Israel and Palestine. The Israeli government has announced it holds the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority directly responsible for Monday's suicide bombing in Tel Aviv. Nine people were killed in the blast, making it the deadliest Palestinian strike against Israel in 2 years. The group Islamic Jihad took responsibility for the bombing, and Hamas said the attack was justified. Israel called Hamas's justifications of the bombing, quote, clear declarations of war. The bombing was widely criticized by the international community. Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri defended his stance, saying, quote, Hamas and the Palestinian people will not buckle in the face of political pressure and blackmail. Meanwhile, Israeli troops clash with hundreds of Palestinian stone throwers in the West Bank city of Nablus Wednesday. Israeli forces reportedly fired tear gas, rubber-coated steel pellets, and some live rounds at the crowds. Israeli troops also arrested more than 20 Palestinians in raids across the West Bank. The father of the Tel Aviv bomber was reported to be among those detained. Israel said it plans to revoke the residency permits of several Hamas MPs living in East Jerusalem. This comes as Japan has confirmed it will halt new aid payments to the Palestinian Authority, adding to a financial crisis. The U.S. and European Union have cut off millions of dollars in aid to the country since Hamas's victory in the January 25th elections, demanding Hamas recognize Israel and renounce violence. Last week, Oxfam International warned that the humanitarian crisis in the West Bank and Gaza will only worsen in response to international aid cuts. For more on the humanitarian situation, we begin with Adrienne Smith, spokesperson for Oxfam. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk both about the situation in the occupied territories now, who has cut off aid, what it means, and also about the latest suicide bombing?
Well, obviously, we're very concerned about the humanitarian situation. People there were living in a very difficult environment already. So a cutoff of aid would have very serious implications.
And the suicide bombing that just took place?
Well, obviously, that has even more serious implications because it really distracts in a really horrific, horrifying way from the situation and the very precarious situation for people living on both sides who have very real security needs. So obviously we're very horrified by that and very much renounce the situation, hope that it can be resolved.
How is the occupied territories affected by the aid cutoffs?
Well, what happened is that as the European community decided that they wanted to cut off aid to the territory, to the Palestinian Authority specifically, there was a hope and a desire that NGOs like an Oxfam or the Red Cross would be able to continue aid so that people were unaffected, so that one could both simultaneously cut off the Palestinian Authority, but also not have people affected. And we don't believe that that's possible. Oxfam is providing the only source of clean water to about 140,000 villages and to families who depend on that. And so we certainly will do everything we can to help people, but we do not feel that we can replace the Palestinian Authority and the infrastructure that existed. And the Red Cross has done a similar assessment, as have other groups, and we just feel that that is not a scenario that's going to work. So we are talking about people being hurt.
Your figures at Oxfam, Palestinians in the occupied territories, 60% of them live on about $2 a day?
That's exactly right. And living in deep need like that, they're not in a position where they've set aside provisions, they haven't been able to stock up. So this would cause a real change in their livelihoods, and that's not a change that these people can afford.
I want to thank you for being with us, Adrienne Smith, spokesperson for Oxfam, speaking to us from Boston. For more on the latest news out of the occupied territories, we're joined on the phone by Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies and the Director of Middle East Institute at Columbia University. He's also the author of several books, his latest, Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. We're also joined on the phone from Israel by Shir Hever, an economic researcher for the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem. Professor Rashid Khalidi, your description of what is happening right now in the occupied territories and the European Union, the United States, Canada, now Japan, cutting off aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority.
I think that what's happening is an intensification of the situation that's existed really for the past 6 years. You have a population basically in prison, which is now under sort of a lockdown almost, with almost no movement and with very, very limited ability to engage in economic activity, which is now being further punished by this removal of aid. That's the basic situation. It's gotten worse, I think, because of this terrorist attack the other day, which I think will just enable further pressure to be put on the Palestinian people. I think the irresponsibility of Palestinian politicians obviously is part of this, but the cruelty of the international community in punishing 3.5 million people for the political decisions of its leaders and for their votes is really quite extraordinary and I think quite despicable. I believe that the responsible power, which is Israel, the occupying power, and the international community have a responsibility to this population, which has absolutely nothing to do with the political aspects, which should be completely separate.
In your response to Hamas saying they do not condemn the suicide bombing in Tel Aviv.
Well, until Hamas and other Palestinian groups understand that attacks on civilians, any civilians, are morally wrong, politically mistaken, and in my view are war crimes, they are going to have real trouble pushing the Palestinian cause forward. I understand the argument that the Palestinians have a right to resist. I don't think that that absolves them of moral considerations, like you do not kill women and children. And I mean, I think that Hamas is, frankly, put itself in an absolutely impossible position. They agreed to run in Palestinian elections, which were held under agreements that they never approved of, but which involve responsibilities. And I don't think they're living up to those responsibilities. And I think they're doing this in a very cynical way, because I think they understand that the international pressure that's put on the Palestinian people may make public opinion in the occupied territories rally behind them. But the suffering that's being inflicted on the Palestinians is quite extraordinary. And I really don't think the international community should be mixing these two things.
Sher Haver, you're an economic researcher for the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem. You're a Jewish Israeli. Your response to the situation right now, the cutoff of aid and also the attack in Tel Aviv being supported by Hamas?
I think the cutting of the aid shows a deep hypocrisy in the international community and also in Israel, because these same powers were the ones who pressured the Palestinians in the first place to hold the democratic elections. And what the Palestinians need was not the democratic elections. Of course, the democratic elections are important, but what they really need most urgently is the end of the occupation. And after the Palestinians did hold a democratic election that was supervised by international observers and was deemed to be very democratic and very free and chose Hamas, the same powers who demanded that they make this election are now punishing the Palestinians for their choice in the election. Now, the main question to be asked at this point is whether the Palestinians, whether the Hamas government will be able to find alternative sources of funding. Or without these sources of funding, will we see a deterioration of the conflict into more intense and more violent than it used to be so far?
What has been the response inside Israel to both situations, to the attack and also to Hamas having support cut off?
Well, first of all, it's Israeli policy to cut off the support for the Hamas. And it's important to know that Israel is obligated by international law to provide money that was in the first place due to the Palestinians. It's taxes from Palestinian workers who, according to the agreements, must be transferred to the Palestinian Authority. It's customs that Israel is collecting for on behalf of the Palestinians and taking a very large percentage to itself. And the fact that Israel is withholding the money is by itself illegal. But the Israeli public does not really recognize this fact, and there is a general consensus, at least among the Zionist parties and the newly elected government, that the aid should be stopped to the Hamas. But at the same time, when the alarms about the humanitarian catastrophe that is impending in the occupied territories increase, these same parties actually encourage some emergency donations, some emergency assistance, because Israel, in a way, realizes that it still holds a responsibility over the Palestinian population. Even though it's not recognizing this fact, I think we all know that this humanitarian catastrophe will be Israel's fault. And I think the international community knows that. And Israel also has to prevent this catastrophe from happening in order not to be accused of killing large amounts of Palestinians by starvation.
On Monday, Professor Khalidi, Israel's ambassador called Iran, Syria, and Hamas government the new axis of terror and said the recent statements by the PA in relation to recent suicide bombings were clear declarations of war. Your response?
Well, I mean, he's the ambassador for propaganda in New York, Israeli ambassador. His job is to stir things up, and he's doing a wonderful job of it. We are on a steep slope, I'm afraid, towards war with Iran in this country, and or at least major strikes against Iran, which are acts of war. And I believe that the Israeli military is planning. I mean, if the Israeli press is to be believed, the Israeli military is planning and may soon be launching much more serious operations in the occupied territories. So this is part of the drumbeat to war. It's rather amusing that he should have mentioned Syria, because when the Bush administration quite recently was considering bringing down the Syrian regime, it was reported, at least in Israel, and quite extensively, that the Israeli government warned the Bush administration against doing this, saying that the alternatives would be much worse, that the situation with Syria is perfectly stable, and that however bad the Assad government was, they would much rather have them there than any of the possible alternatives. So it's a cynical statement, obviously partly generated by anger at this attack in which 9 Israelis were killed in Tel Aviv, but I think largely generated by the need to continue the drumbeat over Iran, and to prepare for what is coming insofar as the occupied territories are concerned. I mean, and I think your other speaker mentioned the point that I don't think anybody should forget. In June, we will begin the 40th year of occupation. This occupation has gone on for 2/3 of the existence of the State of Israel, 2 generations in the life of Palestinians. It's completely unacceptable. It's illegal. It's become considerably more onerous, a burden on the Palestinian people every year, and the last 6 or 7 years have been completely intolerable. And it goes on and on and on without anybody ever talking about it as the core of the problem. It's not even mentioned as a major problem. This has to be ended, or we're going to see more and more actions like the one we saw in Tel Aviv. I abhor them. I think that they are the worst possible thing, not just for the Israelis, but for the Palestinians. But I see no way of even beginning to address what drives people to do this unless you can end this occupation. It's been going on for 39 years. In June, it will be the beginning of the 40th year of it, and I see no movement in the international community. I see nothing in this country, nothing whatsoever, to address it. And anytime anyone tries to address it in this country, we're screamed down as Israel haters, or we're screamed down as anti-Semites. And so the occupation rolls on, protected by this kind of rhetoric.
I want to ask you both to stay with us for a few more minutes, but we have to break right now for 60 seconds. Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Sher Hever is economic researcher at the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem. Stay with us.
شهيد والألم من الصميم ما عاد فينا نتحمل عهالظلم يا عالم الصبر لربك التحكيم على أرواحهم لنقرأ بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم 13 شهيد أفر الدمع دليل على القبر لساته عم بيسيل أخذته لكثير دمع اللي سال على دمه اللي سال قال استخسرته فينا ليش حتى الأقل من القليل 13 شهيد ايه ما صعب الفراق مو العين ما بتكفي بكى وأنين ما بفيد 13 شهيد ايه ما أقوى الاشتياق وجع بزيد كيف قطعتوا الدم عن الوريد موطني الشباب لن يكل همه أن تستقل أو يبيد نستقي من الردى ولن نكون للعداء كالعبيد جينا لنحكي القصة ودمعي بعيني لسه قالوا لي إيش يا خاين الخاين اللي بينسى كيف صار وقلبك يقصى تمشي وتنسى القصة تنسى الماضي اللي كاين والخوف بقلبك يرسى كيف ننسى دم اللي راح ما راح خليته طالع من بيته وعالراي وطالع
Palestinian rap group Dam here on Democracy Now! democracynow.org The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman speaking with Sher Hever, who is an economic researcher for the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem. Rashid Khalidi joins us from here in New York. He's Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies and Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. On Friday, the U.S. government barred Americans from doing most business with the Palestinian Authority. The Treasury Department memo said transactions with the PA by U.S. persons are prohibited unless licensed. It said that the decision had been based on existing terrorism sanctions. Professor Khalidi, your response to this, and how significant is this?
Well, it is significant. I think it's part of this blunderbuss legislation, which treats anyone who deals with anything, which has anything to do with anything, which can be described as terrorist, as illegal. And it's a very blunt tool. I mean, there is a problem with the financing of terror, and there is a legitimate concern, particularly when we're talking about things like Al-Qaeda, which actually attacked the United States. It has been largely used in this country against supporters of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, by the way. A large number of the terror trials that this administration has engaged in have had nothing to do with attacks on Americans, or at least nothing to do with attacks in the United States. I think that it will make even more complicated the task of humanitarian organizations dealing with the consequences of Israel's occupation. I only wish that the United States would face up to the fact that Israel, as the occupying power under the Third Geneva Convention, is responsible for the safety and the welfare of the entire Palestinian population under occupation. The sham and the fiction that there is a Palestinian sovereign independent government which has that responsibility is in law completely unjustified. Israel is the occupying power. The Palestinian Authority has no sovereignty and almost no jurisdiction, and is about to be eliminated almost as its limited control is further eroded. And that means we in the international community and Israel are responsible for the welfare of these people. Laws like this, which are as blunt and as indiscriminate as they are going to make individuals who are trying to deal with these humanitarian problems very worried about their safety from prosecution. And I would remind you, you can deliver humanitarian aid in a variety of ways through NGOs, but some things have to be delivered by a quasi-governmental body like education and health. And that has to be this Palestinian Authority, which has simply taken over the services that were performed by Israel's civil administration in the many decades of occupation before the PA was set up in the mid-90s. And that has now been described as a terrorist authority, both by Israel and the United States. Well, terrorist teachers and terrorist doctors and terrorist nurses and terrorist tax collectors, it is obscene. It makes absolutely no sense. But it is a weapon that this administration has chosen to wield, both an ideological weapon and a financial weapon, and here in the case of Palestine and elsewhere. And until the American public wakes up and realizes that we're not well served by these laws, I think we're in real trouble.
Do you think that the economic crisis will destabilize Hamas?
It may. It's hard for me at this distance to judge. But I think that Hamas may, the Hamas government may crumble. I don't think that will necessarily mean that Hamas will be less popular or that it will be possible to create a stable alternative to it. I think destroying the democratic process in Palestine, which would be the result of that, wouldn't be good for anybody. We would go back to a situation where armed groups would dictate Palestinian policy, which was the situation for much of the Intifada, which I think was one of the worst things that could possibly have happened to the Palestinian people. I don't think the Intifada served them well, the second Intifada, the one from 2000 until 2004, 2005. And I'm afraid that that is where that is where the situation is being pushed. And I think that will be catastrophic, both for the Palestinians and the Israelis. Frankly, I don't think the Israelis will benefit one bit either.
The Telegraph, a London tabloid, Shir Hever, reported Saturday that aid...
It's actually a broadsheet, Amy.
Okay. Reported Saturday aid work has been nearly paralyzed on the West Bank because many aid workers fear the United States now sees them as terrorists.
Yes, I think the United States is only proving to a large extent that the money... that it's double standards towards terrorism. Because while the United States is putting all these obstacles in the face of people who try to deal with Palestinian businesses, at the same time, the United States is funding the Israeli occupation of the occupied territories, and it's providing Israel with weapons with which Israel violates international law, violates human rights, and commits atrocities against the Palestinian population. So it's actually the United States government itself that is responsible for many violent actions that Israel is committing and is funding these actions. And we should ask ourselves if morally, is that any better than funding terrorist Islamic organizations?
And where do you think the change will come from in Israel? Is there a peace movement that you feel actually has weight?
Well, I am part of the anti-occupation forces in Israel. I wouldn't exactly call it a peace movement because the peace movement is a very general name. But I think the forces against the occupation in Israel are not very strong, especially not the Jewish parts of that movement. What is very strong, however, is the gradual erosion of the Israeli society's ability to maintain the occupation, to keep bearing the economic burdens, the social burdens. Israel used to be one of the most egalitarian and fast-growing economies in the Western world, and today it's the most unequal economy in the Western world, if at all it is part of the Western world. It suffers from high levels of unemployment, and a lot of people are losing interest in the Zionist nature of the state because of that, and they're becoming more apathic and more centered about their daily survival. And this is actually the source, as cynical as it may sound, this is the source of hope for a solution to the situation, because only when Israelis are not willing to participate in the army and in the actions that it undertakes, only then we can the Palestinians will be finally able to claim their independence and their rights.
Sheikh Hever, we'll have to leave it there. Economic researcher for the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem, and Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said, professor of Arab Studies and director of Middle East Institute at Columbia University in New York. As we turn now to part two of our conversation with legendary Nigerian writer and political activist Wole Soyinka, the first African ever to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. For decades, he's been an outspoken critic of many Nigerian administrations of political tyrannies around the world. He's author of many novels and plays. His latest work is a memoir. It's called You Must Set Forth at Dawn. Wole Soyinka joined us in our studio yesterday. I began by asking him about the title of his book.
All right, I'll tell you the history of the title. My first working title was Beyond the Word, which is a literal explication of the contents of the book, of the nature of the events which are described in the book. But then one of my editors, I went through three editors, by the way, all of them were on a very positive kind of direction. And one of the editors ran into that poem of mine, which contains the lines, "Traveler, you must set forth at dawn." The title was Death in the Dawn. And she became very enamored of that title. And when she proposed it, I said, no. And then I tried it out on some of my friends. And they said, no, that's more lyrical, more poetic. I said, yes, I know it is, but, you know, why? Why must... So I actually took a straw vote on that, some of my colleagues and so on. Beyond the word, you must set forth at dawn. And the voting came to about 60-40. And since I'm a true Democrat, I decided to go with you must set forth at dawn.
And why did you want beyond the word?
Simply because of an incident which once took place. I had an encounter with a young fellow who believed very much in indiscriminate violence and was praising the bringing down of a plane with the innocent people in it. And I said to him, and he said, and I said, no, I don't believe in that kind of action. There are certain forms of violence which are unavoidable and which can be justified in the course of freedom, democracy, justice, and so on and so forth. I said, but I do not believe in targeting innocents simply because you have a cause which you think is righteous. And he then, in a very supercilious way, said, you see, you're a poet. That's why you feel that way. And I said to him, you know, you're very lucky I had nobody in that plane. So some of us, even poets, live beyond the word. So be careful to whom you next open your mouth. And I've always carried that incident with me over the years, especially as I've been thrown in situations where the question of legitimate violence comes up and I've had to take decisions myself.
Let's talk about some of those times. What landed you in jail in Nigeria?
Well, the first time, first of all, I was on trial. And I was in detention during the trial on the allegation of armed robbery. And what was the armed robbery? I was alleged to have broken into a studio where the Prime Minister, who was stealing an election, was about to announce the very false results and claim the right to continue in office. So I was alleged to have broken into the studio, removed his tape, and made away with it. And so I was charged with armed robbery, which carried a life sentence, of course. And so that was my first brush with the law. I was rather astonished that I should be charged with armed robbery because it was an exchange. I left my tape there and just took his own away.
So when you say tape, you mean?
Oh, you know, we're talking about the old days when you had the old-fashioned tape.
Film.
A recording.
Uh-huh.
What do you call it?
The audio
cassette.
Tape. The cassette.
The cassette. The cassette tape. And so, anyway, I got away with that. I was tried, and I was freed. Then the second round was a bit more grim. It was when I went during the Civil War, at the beginning of the Civil War, when the shooting had just started. And I went on a mission to the Biafrans and to try and pursue them to at least hold ceasefire for some time while we worked out something more equitable between the federal government and the Biafran side. I didn't believe in that war. I felt it was an unjust war on the part of the federal government because the Biafrans had suffered a great deal. They'd undergone the experience of genocide at the hands of a section of Nigeria. And while their action was politically unwise, I did not find it morally reprehensible, and it certainly did not deserve that they should be clobbered anew by the full federal might when they were the immediate past victims. So anyway, I belonged to a group which wanted to create what we called a third force. And so I went to speak to the leader of the Biafrans, and when I came back, I was arrested, and I was never tried. I was just flung in jail for a couple of years.
And what kept your spirits up and your sanity during 2 years of solitary confinement?
I think, first of all, it was the realization of the purpose of the abnormal thing that was being done. You don't lock somebody up by himself or herself unless you have very bad designs on that individual. You're going to break him down, you know, destroy the mind. If you didn't want to do that, if all you want to do is keep him out of action to ensure he doesn't interfere in your war or take action against you, well, just give him normal dose of imprisonment. In this case, I was placed in solitary confinement, and I knew there was only a purpose, and that was to destroy my mind. So I invented exercises for myself, meditation, tried to invent mathematical formulas, which I then tried to solve. I hated math in school, so I began to try and recollect those aspects of that discipline, which I disliked intensely. I had no paper, so I scribbled things on the ground, made diagrams, geometrical shapes, and then try to calculate the relationship of the angles, you know, to the lengths and so on. In other words, things which I actually hated in school, I brought them all back and sat down, began from the most elementary principles, the laws of permutations and combination, etc., etc. So all that kept my mind very, very active.
I think I interviewed you during the reign of Sani Abacha when he was dictator of Nigeria. You were here. I believe a death sentence had been issued against you.
No, yeah, there's always a mistake about that. I was placed on trial for treason. I was declared wanted, dead or alive. And with a group of others, I was tried in absentia. Before sentence was actually passed, Abacha very kindly took his leave of the world.
So it was right before. But can you talk about your country, Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa? And when, in a case like Sani Abacha, you have a you had a military dictator who was shored up by other countries, and perhaps more importantly, other other companies, and that's the oil companies that that take their oil from the Niger Delta.
You see, the outside world, during especially during the Cold War and for some time afterwards, both sides, includes both the the Soviet bloc and the Western capitalist bloc, believe very much in collaborating with the what I call the mythological strongman. The strongman of Zaire, the strongman of Ghana, the strongman of Zimbabwe. That syndrome, strongmanism as I call it, was very much an obsession with the with Western and Eastern powers. Sekou Touré was a strongman for the Soviet Union. So it was both sides of the ideological divide. And what that meant, of course, was that in one case, you dealt directly with one individual who imposed his political and economic will, strategies of social transformation on the entire populace, a very rigid, draconian, totalitarian form of government, but leaning presumably towards the progressive side. On the other, you had direct, unabashed exploitation. The multinational companies, the agents, business agents of various governments, and they enjoyed that facility of being able to pick up the phone, speak to only one individual, receive all concessions, receive troops, even to suppress, to oppress the people, whose land they were exploiting for the either oil or diamonds or whatever. So this preference, instead of going through a democratic process in which your activities are monitored by the House of Assembly, complaints are brought, committees are set up, commissions are set up, accountability is the law under a proper democratic dispensation. And these companies, of course, didn't want that. All they had to do is pay one individual, just what's your bank account in Switzerland, what's your bank account in Saudi Arabia, in Britain. And so this strongmanism created an atmosphere of suppression, a reality of suppression and corruption, which is still with us today. They loved dealing with military dictators because everything was simple.
Which is still with you today. Explain.
Very much with us in certain parts, but it's changing slowly. It's changing slowly. But the legacy is still with us. In Nigeria, for instance, we are supposed to be practicing a democracy, but we have an ex-military man who has not given up his bad old ways.
I remember when Obasanjo second became, because he'd been a leader of four and had come back, and he was being introduced in this country. He was taken to Dr. Martin Luther King's church in Atlanta and escorted around by the head of Chevron Corporation and then brought up here to New York.
That is itself significant. You see, they were accustomed to dealing with, corporate heads, directly, and those corporate heads were very much at home with, dictators.
Speaking with the legendary Nigerian writer, the Nobel laureate, Wole Soyinka. We'll be back with him in a minute.
You be thief.
I love be thief.
You be rogue.
I love be rogue.
You be steal.
I love be steal.
You be robber.
I love be robber.
You be am robber.
I love be am robber.
You be thief.
I love be thief.
Rogue.
I know be rogue.
You be steal.
I know be steal.
You be robber.
I know be robber.
You be am robber.
I be am robber.
I know be thief.
You be thief.
I know be rogue.
You be rogue.
I know be steal.
You be steal.
I know be robber.
You be robber.
I know be am robber.
You be am robber.
I know be thief.
You be thief.
I know be rogue.
You be rogue.
and not they steal.
They steal.
And not be rubber. And not be yam rubber. Argument, argument, argue.
Argument, argument.
Them argue.
Fela singing Authority Stealing here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we return to our conversation with the Nobel laureate, Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, who is actually Fela's cousin. He joined us in our studio yesterday, and I asked him about his perspective on the invasion and occupation of Iraq and how it affects Africa.
It's not only for the African continent, but for the entire world. This is one of the most unbelievably monumental disasters, miscalculations, acts of governmental irresponsibilities with consequences which would be with the world for a very, very long time. Lots of Africans do not fully understand the issues in Iraq. Oils are indifferent. They have their own problems. If you like, they have their own mini Iraqs, you know, on their hands. And so the blunders of countries like the United States are spoken of almost in a kind of academic way, not in terms of the effect, the impact of such blunders in the world. Impacts such as the distrust of the United States, distrust even of some of the positive role that it can play in a situation like Darfur, for instance. But that distrust runs so deep that the sore of Darfur can just expand and pollute the entire region. Whereas if the moral authority of the United States had not been so badly damaged, it might have been able to influence what's happening in Darfur a lot more, operating through the Africa Union or through the United Nations. So Iraq, the ramifications of the events in Iraq really have been very bad for Africa generally.
And the Niger Delta, we talked about it in our first part of the interview, but the level of militancy, the anger at the oil companies coming into the Niger Delta, this organization called MEND, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, can you tell us who they are?
They're very young, mostly very highly motivated people who, however, have links with some of the elders, the progressive elders in the region, in Bayelsa, for instance, in Ijaw region. Many of them belong to the Ijaw ethnic group, and from all indications, they're very articulate. The ones whom I have spoken to have asked me to intervene in a number of ways in Nigeria. They're very articulate. And at the same time, they're reluctant rebels. Take, for instance, an email which one of them sent to me. He said, Prof, listen, we are people who would rather be with our families, raising our children, sending them to school. We're not happy, you know, carrying out operations in the creeks. We want to be home. We want all this to be over so we can return to our families. I said, but what future do our children have? There are no schools, there are no clinics. All the wealth from this region is going to Abuja, is going to sustain the rest of the nation. So it's about time that we took a stand. We want you to understand this. This is the kind of language which they use. It's not bravado. It's not crude, thuggish kind of people. At least the ones who
the way it's conveyed in the United States is kidnappers, thugs, people who blow up oil pipelines.
Well, it's unfortunate that they have that image. I've discussed this with them also. I've tried to persuade them, for instance, that hostage taking will be counterproductive and will actually alienate lots of supporters. That they must learn to not to follow a particular pattern of condemnable violence. And I have a feeling that once the negotiations, which have yielded a certain result, like the Yenagoa Accord, once the conditions, the conditions of those accords are fulfilled by the government, once the international community actually supervises and compels the federal government to, you know, abide by those agreements, I have a feeling that we will, and once a greater deal of autonomy is conceded to that region, in other words, the right to control their own resources, to pay a tax to the center, and to determine the priorities of their own development, whether it's education, health, to actually develop that entire degraded area. But once these just demands are met, I have a feeling that we'll see the end of unrest in the Delta region.
The responsibility of the oil companies, what do you see it as?
Oh, that's part of the conditions. Also, the oil companies are expected to pay compensation for the damage they have done to the environment. Yes, that's one of the conditions they've written there.
We're talking to Wole Soyinka. You talked about health just this past week in South Africa. So African leaders gathering to talk about prevention of AIDS and new HIV infection. Can you talk about AIDS in Africa and what people here should understand?
Well, first of all, there was very serious a level of ignorance even among African leaders at the beginning. There was a lot of denial. AIDS was not what AIDS was. HIV did not lead to AIDS, and all kinds of theorizing from these ignorant leaders who should have left this epidemic to the medical scientists to deal with, to the virologists to deal with. And they kept trying to follow policies which were contrary to the scientific findings of this plague. And so they lost a lot of time, a lot of time. Villages have been, entire villages have been completely denuded of the population. AIDS is rampant in many of the urban cities today. It's reached Nigeria, yeah, in alarming proportions. And very belatedly, but at long last, this disease is now being taken seriously. Collaboration is going on with outside bodies, foundations, for instance, such as run by Clinton, who's collaborating also with Nelson Mandela's own foundation. There's a consciousness and a late but very serious-minded effort now to stem the tide of this disease. Educational policies. The wife of Museveni, for instance, is one of the leaders in the campaign against AIDS, the First Lady. And Brown Brothers involved, is a medical doctor, is involved in the AIDS campaign. There's a lot of serious work being done.
We're talking to Wole Soyinka. His memoir is called You Must Set Forth at Dawn. You have a chapter called Requiem for an Echo Warrior.
Yes, that's the Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was hanged together with eight of his companions by Sani Abacha. One of the most traumatic moments of the struggle against Sani Abacha. I was in Auckland during the summit of the Commonwealth Heads of State to persuade them to intervene very forcefully and urgently on behalf of those nine Ogoni people. Unfortunately, they found it difficult to believe. I spoke to prime ministers, I spoke to foreign ministers. Ken's son was there, Ken Jr. He was also, you know, part of the campaign, you know, frantically trying to make them understand that Abacha was not a creature they knew, that he was very different from everything they had ever known. But they found it difficult to believe. And
now, Ken Saro-Wiwa was imprisoned by
Sani Abacha,
had taken on Shell Corporation. He'd
taken on Shell Corporation very, very fiercely. In fact, he was, when I was in Auckland, one of the moments, unforgettable moments, was when a group of activists, New Zealanders, were staging some street drama all over the place with huge effigies of Shell, slogans and so on. And I was walking despondently through the streets, just wondering what on earth was going to happen to Ken in prison. And suddenly, as I write in the book, there was Ken, and I just saw this huge signs up, "Free Ken Saro-Wiwa, Shell is hell," etc., etc. And it was a very uplifting moment, all the way from the Niger Delta to New Zealand to find this demonstration supposed to educate the heads of state about the imminent danger in which Ken and his colleagues stood at the time. But it unfortunately came to nothing, and Bacha went ahead and killed those people.
November 10th, 1995 was the day they died. It's 11 years later. Do you see progress?
There is some. There is a greater consciousness now of the responsibility, which is owed by the oil companies. But those responsibilities are not yet being made concrete. They're not being affected. We had statements of intent, and in some cases we've had a road here and there, built a clinic here, but we're talking about undoing the damage of several decades. And it's something which has got to be done in collaboration with the government. But above all, the resources of those people must be returned to them to manage, and let them pay, as happens in all other areas, let them pay tax to the center. This is one of the proposals, for instance, of the People's Constitutional Conference, which is going on in Nigeria as I'm speaking to you, called PRONACO, because we're saying the constitution, Nigerian constitution as it stands, is a fake. It is forced upon the people by the military, and the contents, the structure of that constitution makes for centralization, which is a military, which is the love of the military, complete centralization. We say, no, we're no longer under the military. Let more and more autonomy devolve onto the states so that you weaken the center and you give the people, you return the power, the authentic power to the people to manage their own destinies. And we'll meet at the center for essential things like defense, mutual defense, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, we're trying to change that pattern of militaristic thinking.
And what do you say to countries like the United States, where oil is so important and the U.S. increasingly turning to places where they end up using force to get that oil, mm-hmm. whether it's Iraq, Nigeria is certainly a major oil provider in the world. What do you say as a Nigerian to the people of the United States?
Well, simply that they must understand that what fuels their industry is really the blood of other people. And therefore, a greater sense of responsibility across the waters is demanded from this government, and of which, of course, the United States is the most conspicuous consumer of this product. Running away from a mess which you've created simply because there is an easier access to oil somewhere else does not lessen the responsibility for what has already taken place.
Wole Soyinka, the legendary Nigerian writer, first African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. His latest memoir is called You Must Set Forth at Dawn. And that does it for today's program. For a copy of the show, you can visit our website at democracynow.org. Also, our transcripts are there. I'll be in Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater Thursday at 4 p.m. and on Friday and Saturday in Portland, Oregon at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, as well as celebrating KBOO. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Phil Dokuduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg, Peshkin, Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.